Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is author and photographer Carol Gallagher. During her 20s, Carol achieved much success as an artist photographer in New York, with exhibitions at what was then considered the most prestigious gallery in the art world, Leo Castelli Gallery, in 1978 and 81. Carol also exhibited in museums and galleries nationally and internationally before moving to Utah in 1983. There she began work on a documentary book about the effects of nuclear testing in Nevada on those living downwind, the test site workers themselves, and atomic veterans who are exposed to the bombs at very close range and made to walk over ground zero shortly after each bomb exploded. This program was to expose soldiers to the bomb and was experimental to see what a man could withstand emotionally and physically on the nuclear battlefield should a full-scale nuclear war occur or nuclear exchanges on a more limited scope. Carol returned to New York in 1990 after much harassment by locals, even death threats. Her book, American Ground Zero, The Secret Nuclear War, was published by the MIT Press in 1993. Then in 1997, Carol Gallagher began work on a documentary about the sickened veterans of the First Gulf War. After 7 years of work on this book, she was disabled in an accident and had to stop working in photography. For the last 5 years, she's been alternating writing books and recovering from four surgeries, which have enabled her to walk again and use her right arm. Carol Gallagher, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Carol, I realise now that I've had a copy of your book, American Ground Zero, around my house for many years, but I've never actually stopped and read it. And I've been absolutely flabbergasted by it. It's as well as full of the most extraordinary photographs, the stories of these people and what they endured as the testing occurred is absolutely, again, extraordinary. I just want to read a paragraph from the foreword by Keith Schneider. Over the next 12 years, from 1951, in the United States, a government nuclear cold warriors detonated 126 atomic bombs into the atmosphere at the 1,350 square mile Nevada test site. Each of the pink clouds that drifted across the flat mesas and forbidden valleys of the atomic proving grounds contained levels of radiation comparable to the amount released after the explosion in 1986 of the Soviet nuclear reactor at Chernobyl. I'll repeat that. Each of the bombs exploded at the Nevada test site contained the amounts of radiation comparable to that released of the explosion in 1986 of Chernobyl. And then there's a map in the front, areas of the continental United States crossed by more than one nuclear cloud from above ground detonations. Remember, one nuclear cloud equals one Chernobyl explosion, which contaminated 40% of Europe for hundreds or thousands of years. Virtually the whole of the United States is covered with fallout, and many of these clouds intersected and combined together right over to the East Coast, and I know that New York got a lot, but the whole of the East Coast.
That's right.
Oh,
I know.
Well, so reading this book, I think that this book should become compulsory reading for every child in secondary school, every child in college, and every American citizen. I mean, I know a lot about radiation and what's happened, but these people We're exposed to experimentation and we're lied to again and again and again, and thousands of them died of leukemia and cancer. So, Carol, what got you to start documenting what happened in Utah, Nevada, South Dakota? How did you hear about it? And tell us what happened.
When I was a child in the 50s, I was born in 1950,
right.
And you might remember that these explosions at the Nevada test site were viewed as some kind of making of history, and even Walter Cronkite would review on television and in the news from NewsNob, which is the place for reporters at the Nevada test site, and it was made to sound awesome, and it was a macho building exercise, of course, but this was a scientific program that was not necessary. Even Robert Oppenheimer said that testing was something that should never be done.
Robert Oppenheimer was the father of the atomic weapons, and he was the director of the Manhattan Project, for those who
right.
don't know. Yes.
Right. And, you know, even Edward Teller, who's a much, much less admirable character, if we can use the word admirable, who was the father of the H-bomb, when it comes to nuclear power plants, he says, oh, you just must not build them unless you build them 5 miles underground. So these were scientists who knew the effects of the fallout of the radiation, and they just decided to use it as a boondoggle, I think, and a test program and a scientific program. And by the end of it, when we were about to get a test ban treaty for above-ground tests in 63, they were exploding a nuclear bomb once a week just to get their inventory used.
Oh, to get the inventory used.
Yes, and in the test site from AEC, the test site documents, they listed Alamogordo, the first nuclear test, Trinity, the very first bomb exploded in New Mexico. That was a test. And then they listed Hiroshima as a test. And then they listed Nagasaki as a test. And then they had all the tests in the Pacific, which became prohibitively expensive. So they wanted to try to have a test site closer to Los Alamos and the other places where the bomb material was produced. And they chose this test site north of Las Vegas.
Well, now,
because it was easier and less expensive.
The tests in the Pacific, I believe, were mostly hydrogen bombs and were vastly bigger than the ones exploded at Nevada test site. What dates, over what period of time were the bombs tested in the Pacific, Carol Gallagher?
From 1945, right after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, through 51. But they were still testing hydrogen bombs in the Pacific because they said they would never explode a hydrogen bomb on domestic soil. But they did, actually. There was one hydrogen bomb, at least, exploded in the atmosphere at the Nevada test site.
Right. What was it called?
I think that was Simon. And it was huge. It was a huge, huge test.
How many megatons?
It wasn't megatons, it was 60 kilotons, I believe, but I could be slightly wrong because this book was published a long time ago.
Just for people, first of all, an atomic bomb is just made of plutonium or enriched uranium, and the ones that were first tested, Trinity, named after the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and Hiroshima, little boy, and Nagasaki, fat man, were small bombs, really about 13 kilotons, which is equal to the explosion of 13,000 tons of TNT. But then Edward Teller, who was really, I think there's a hot place reserved in hell for Teller, maybe he's there now, he then designed the hydrogen bomb, which uses an atomic bomb only as a trigger mechanism.
Right.
So you get fission in the atomic bomb, and then you get a fusion reaction, the same as occurs inside the sun, and then you get another fission reaction with uranium-238 in the cladding of the bomb. So they can be any size you want, and some of them were 50 megatons, equivalent to 50 million tons of TNT. And most of the weapons in the arsenals now of America and Russia are hydrogen bombs, and that's Teller's legacy. But let's go back. I'm just giving a little history, Carol. What then triggered you to be interested in this and go out to these places?
Oh, here we are. We're back with Walter Cronkite.
Yes.
Because I was 5 years old in 1955,
right.
And the bombs were being tested, and it had been 10 years by that time that the nuclear weapons were apparent on the face of the earth. And I lived in Brooklyn, New York, in a really beautiful part named Bay Ridge. And I asked my father, I said, how many miles are we from Times Square? And if there was a hydrogen bomb exploded in Times Square, would we survive? And, you know, a little ahead of my time.
Yes.
Well, that was 7 miles away. And my father got this incredible look on his face. I sometimes think the looks tell it all.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, we'd be perfectly safe, you know, perfectly safe. So, I mean, the cloud would be out as far as we were, where we were living in Brooklyn. And so I became rather interested in anything nuclear that I could get my hands on, including nuclear power, and I did reports on it in school.
But when you were five, how did you know about this, Carol?
Because it's on the television with Walter Cronkite.
Oh, of course, Uncle Walter.
He's reporting from the test site.
Right.
It might have been a little later when he started reporting.
Yeah.
But I was so amazed that this killer bomb could be exploded again.
Yeah.
And then I learned that they were doing them in Nevada since I was 1 year old.
Right.
And I thought, well, what happens to the people in Nevada?
Yeah.
And so the Atomic Energy Commission said that whole part of the country, the West, was relatively uninhabited. Now, the relationship, relatively uninhabited, the people downwind started to call themselves relative uninhabitants.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of people living there, and within 250 miles of Ground Zero at the test site, there were 250,000 people living.
Quarter of a million.
Yes. So there, and then that wasn't all, because the fallout clouds would drift up into the Rocky Mountains, and the fallout would get in the snow. So the Rockies in Utah are famous for skiing. It's alpine skiing. It's very beautiful. And people would be skiing in radioactive snow. And the same was happening. It was going up into South Dakota. And there was a fellow at the School of Mines in Rapid City who was also working for the Atomic Energy Commission. And when he discovered that the puddles in the streets of Rapid City were radioactive, he sounded an alert in the town before he informed the AEC. And they brought him down to Nevada and questioned him and reprimanded him. So it was secret that it was dangerous. It was well publicized that it was happening by the news. And it was a macho thing that we had this. And it's still a macho thing for countries that are getting the bomb. It's like you can't be a power on the planet unless you have a nuclear weapon.
And it's still a macho thing in America in the military.
Yes.
and the scientific community involved in still designing hydrogen bombs. So, okay, the book that, well, first of all, the populations, let's talk about that, who were most intimately exposed time and time and time again. And they describe in your book, Carol, Ground Zero, what happened when the bombs exploded and how they were covered in this sort of dust, and the children played in it thinking it was snow and the like.
Yeah,
yeah, why don't you talk a bit about that? And who were the populations that got most exposed and why?
Well, Utah and parts of Nevada and Idaho, the areas of the West around Salt Lake City are largely Mormon. Salt Lake City was the place where the Mormons escaped to. They walked across the plains with their belongings in hand carts, very brave, intrepid people to escape religious persecution in the East. So So this was their land, and they were people who believed that the government was divinely inspired and that the Constitution was given to us, of the United States was given to us directly by God, by revelation, and other peculiar, rather authoritarian, loving ideas. So these were not people who were going to object. And the church itself made a point of it in the weekly meetings that this was a good thing. They were participating in a moment of history. The schools themselves had these road shows where a general would come in and tell them how lucky they were to be living at this time of history and participate. Mm. And then school teachers would actually bring their classes out to watch the bombs go off. And then the children, I remember Joanne Workman described this. They were in a geology class, and they were to stay out after the cloud went over, or as it was going over, for 5 hours to identify geology specimens. And when Joanne Workman returned home to St. George, there were police there at the entry to the town, and they were washing off vehicles because all the vehicles were loaded with radiation. And by the time Joanne Workman got home, she ran her fingers through her hair and then tried to brush out the fallout. And her scalp was so badly burned that it just lifted right off in the hairbrush and it never grew back. And she had tremendous radiation burns. And so by the time she was in her 40s, she had 5 different kinds of cancer. And the way she coped was to move to California and become part of an experiment in cancer treatment at Stanford University. And what she had to do in order to become part of that program was to sign paperwork that she would never sue the government or the university for exposure to the atomic bomb.
Well, the University of California, of course, the regents oversee, I can't remember the word I'm looking for, the whole Lawrence Livermore labs. Mm-hmm. In fact, all the labs, Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore.
Yes.
So, and on the one hand, they're educating students to live a good and healthy life, and on the other hand, they're working to blow up the students. I put that quite frankly, but I, you know, that's obvious.
Well, you know, the other thing that happened is that the collaboration between the church being faithful to the government and all of that caused the University of Utah, which is a world-class institution now but was more or less of an agricultural college at the time, It got all these really lucrative government contracts. One was for a cancer study of leukemia. The other was a cancer study of thyroid cancer, which there were whole wards of children with leukemia. Oh. And then another scientific program to go down to southern Utah and take out the bricks from people's houses to see how much radiation had penetrated into the houses. And so then they got more federal grants for artificial intelligence, and they had a tremendous, tremendous computer lab there, one of the best in the world. And then the artificial heart, and you name it. They got federal contracts, scientific awards to proceed with experimentation.
Yeah. Leaves me feeling speechless. I want you to now elucidate some of the case histories, the more potent ones. I mean, they're all potent, that particularly stick in your memory, Carol Gallagher, when you photographed these people and took their verbal...
oral history.
Recollections, yes.
There was a family living just north of the test site, and they could actually, when they started to fire atomic bombs from cannons, they could actually see the cannon and see the bomb go off from their front door. So these are people living right due north of the test site, which is a huge property the size of the state of Rhode Island, quite large with many different functions. And the fallout would come over their ranch.
So they were actually in a nuclear war. That's what they were. Anyway, go on.
Well, everybody really was. You know, I mean, it was just testing yeah. on what we could stand, health-wise and otherwise. And so the bomb going off, of course, would shatter their windows, and every once in a while the AEC chaps would come along and ask them how they're doing. And one time one of them brought his daughter, and his daughter loved the ranch and the people living there so much she wanted to stay there. And, of course, the owner of the ranch saw the AEC fellow's eyebrows go up into his forehead because he wasn't going to let his daughter stay there any longer than she had to. Well, this woman, her son, Butch, got leukemia by the time he was 5. Her husband died of lung cancer at a very young age. She gave birth to a baby that was blackened in his body and shriveled from the waist down. And her 2 other daughters have had subcutaneous cancers removed for the rest of their lives. So finally, she had to sell that ranch for a song, and she moved to northern Nevada. And she just lost everything because the ranch wasn't worth anything. It was near the test site. So when I photographed her, and her name is Martha Bordoli Laird, if you look in the book, I photographed her in her barn, and her second husband was a hunter, and they had the heads of 2 slain deer hanging up there to dry in the barn. And I photographed her with holding 2 photographs. One was of their one-room schoolhouse in the community there with the fallout cloud approaching it. And the fallout cloud, it looked like a huge thunderhead. And she said she could stand on the mountain. She could see the thunderhead coming with the tail, the stem of the atomic bomb trailing out behind it. And then she had another picture of the kids in the one-room schoolhouse. And there were only about 6 students, and their teacher, who by that time were all dead. Wow. So, you know, it was so much radiation, and they were so close to it. And it was constant, and it went on until 1963 from 1951.
So how many, is there an estimate, Carol Gallagher, of how many people died from malignancies in that 250,000 population?
There isn't, because what has been done is that if somebody dies of cancer, the death record will not necessarily say they died of cancer, but if they died of extenuating circumstances like post-chemo, they'll have a pneumonia.
Yeah.
And they'll die of pneumonia.
So the doctors were kind of like the Nazi doctors. They participated in this genocide, nuclear genocide.
I can't go that far because I don't understand the culture, and I don't want to make judgments about it. But the truth was there were tons of kids in those hospitals in Salt Lake, because there were no hospitals in southern Utah, who had leukemia. And then as time went on and people in their 30s and 40s started to die, you know, if they were treated with chemo or had a bone marrow transplant and suddenly got an infection, the infection would be called the cause of death in Utah, not necessarily if they went to another part.
Yeah, but when you do a death certificate, and I've done many, you could say the cause of death was pneumonia, but you always say secondary to carcinoma of the liver or whatever.
Right.
Did they do that?
No, they didn't do that.
So I have to say, as a medical doctor, Carol, these my colleagues were participating in nuclear genocide. They were. And the fact is that no one has the documentation or the epidemiology of the number of people who died, of what their doses were, internal and external exposure to radiation, and what cancers they died of, and how old they were, is a crime.
That's a crime. Criminal, but there is epidemiology going on at the University of Utah, and that is federally funded. And I think if you take the king's penny, you do the king's bidding. And I think that there has been definite corroboration of that from people who worked in the studies who said that the numbers were being jiggled. And, you know, that's the thing I worry about. A death certificate is one thing, maybe the doctor himself doesn't do it, or maybe an underling does it and gets instructions. I just don't know how to judge this. But I do know that these studies themselves far underrate the level of cancers, thyroid, and leukemia that happened in these studies. And just the way they were done, you know, they would feel the nodules on the thyroids of people, but they wouldn't remove their thyroid necessarily. You know, they would give palliative care, but never surgical care.
Why?
So they were watching over 30 years to see what would happen to the nodules, to see what the difference would be from a nodule from radioactive iodine compared to other kinds of thyroid cancers. But the truth is, at this point, that by the time baby boomers die, if they die in their 80s, everybody will have at least one thyroid cancer cell because we all drank the milk.
Right across
America. I had thyroid problems when I was in 1964, right after that full year of exploding a bomb a week, because the radiation was going over upstate New York, where the farm country is, the dairy country, and I was drinking milk.
Yeah, well, the Center for Disease Control, CDI, they did a study, I think it was them, on the fallout across America some years ago and the number of cancers, thyroid cancers specifically.
Right.
That, and
1997.
Yeah.
1997, National Cancer Institute
yes.
did that study with maps.
NCI.
And they would actually say how many people in which counties were exposed the worst, and it went right across the country.
And how many? Was it 10,000 they estimated had developed thyroid cancer, Americans or more?
Well, only by now. I mean, it certainly is going to increase.
Yeah.
And right now, I have Hashimoto's disease. I have an immune system disorder which has destroyed my thyroid.
Yeah.
So I went from having it at 14 to having it at 57.
Yeah, but how many did they estimate at that time, 1997? The National Cancer Institute.
I don't have
that in
front of me, but it is online.
It's about 10,000, but maybe it's 100,000 Americans who developed thyroid cancer alone, and that's apart from all the other cancers that are caused by all the radioactive isotopes, plutonium, strontium, cesium, you name it, tritium.
Yeah, the blood cancers with cesium and strontium because they're calcium imitators.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the estimate for death of people on planet Earth from all the nuclear tests of the nuclear powers is 6,290,000 people.
Who estimated that?
I think that was a PSR estimate from years ago.
Huh?
But what we have to realize is that if one in three people who get cancer die, then there's 13 million people who have gotten cancer from testing worldwide, because only one in three will die of it at this point. So that's a Holocaust kind of number.
I don't quite understand that reasoning. Can you walk us through it, Carol Gallagher?
Sure, sure.
I thought one in three people would get cancer in their life, not necessarily die of it, but develop some sort of cancer. One in three.
Well, it's one in three people, but I think of the people who get cancer, one in three die of it, so the survival rate.
Yeah.
So, and we know for breast cancer, it's gone from 1 in 9 to 1 in 8 getting cancer.
In America.
But the point being, of course, that for 6,290,000 people dying, a lot more people have gotten cancer and survived. And so there is cancer there that's been survived, that's been caused by fallout and radiation. And we just have no way of knowing because these numbers are apparently not worth studying.
What?
You know, I mean, you're not going to get a federal grant to find out that you've killed 6,290,000
people. Well, no, but where did that actual figure come from? Was it John Goffman who estimated it or who?
I think it might have been talking with him that came up, because he was the only doctor of that status, you know, who had worked in the Manhattan Project, who actually came forth and spoke out and paid dearly for it, of course. But he gave me most of the numbers I had before I published the book.
Okay. Yeah, well, he was my mentor too. I think his book, Poison Power by Goffman and Tamplin, I read in 75, and I had never known anything about nuclear power at that time, only that bombs, you know, vaporized people. But that was my first introduction to really the medical implications of nuclear power, nuclear fission, and fallout and the like. So, look, Carol, first of all, everyone's got to read this book. I really insist. American Ground Zero, The Secret Nuclear War. It just is the most extraordinary book documenting the medical histories of these lovely, innocent,
sweet people,
patriotic,
sweet and innocent.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah. Who they didn't even take the government on and get. Some of them got angry, but
yes,
some of them remained ultimately patriotic till the end. You know, it's a kind of
is that they're fighting very hard now in northern Utah to have the north part of the state compensated the way the south part of the state was compensated. And I said to one of these activists, I said, this is what turned her on to this in the first place. It was in the late 80s. I said, do you actually think that there was a fence or a wall high enough to stop the radiation in mid-state so that Salt Lake City never got any radiation? And you could see, she was a journalist, and you could see her eyes sort of popping open because she had thyroid cancer. She had had it in her 20s, and she was about 30-something then. And her sister died of lupus, and now her other sister has multiple sclerosis, and, you know, any kind of immune system problem or neurological problem will show up. So, you know, everybody was told it was only southern Utah.
Were they really? Were they?
Yes. Yes.
And they believed it.
Because that was
it.
So close. Yes. And the fallout went across the country, which is why Richard Miller's map at the beginning of the book was so important.
Oh.
You know, just so you can see, here's a cloud, there's a cloud. It's over your hometown. It's over your grandmother's hometown. We all got irradiated one way or another.
Especially when it rained and the cloud was above you. Now, look, let's move on, Carol Gallagher. This project, how long were you out there in Utah and the West doing this work? How long did it take you to take all these photographs and oral histories?
Took about 10 years
altogether.
I lived there for 7 years, and then the harassment got so intense and nightly death threats by phone, and I had to get the police in on it and stuff like that. And I just thought, well, it's not worth losing my life over. I had cars totaled. My apartment had been broken into many times. So I just thought I'll commute for the next 3 years. So it was about 10 years total. I started being interested in 1979, and I moved to Utah in 1983. I left in 1990 and was very happy to leave. And then I published the book with MIT in 1993.
How were you received in Utah when you moved there to do the research?
A pariah.
Why?
You know, well, there's many reasons, sociological reasons. If you have a state that's all one demographic, everybody Mormon, everybody blonde, everybody blue-eyed, intermarried, everybody knows everybody. It's a very small state. There weren't more than a million people in the whole state. And suddenly somebody new shows up from the outside. That's an outsider. And an outsider is not appreciated until they convert.
Oh.
And I wasn't going to convert, you know. Mm. And also, I'm brunette with brown eyes, and people would always come up to me and say, are you Jewish? And they'd actually say that time after time after time. I said, no, I'm Irish and Italian, and that's how it looks.
And
you
I'm
know?
From New York.
Oh, well, I stopped saying that because the New York, everybody hates New York in the West.
Mm.
I mean, everybody in the heartland and other places, because all they know about New York is what they see on television, and I don't think anything you see on television is truthful, but it's a fantasy of some sort of sadistic kind of place. So I stopped saying I was from New York, and I would say I was from the State Historical Society in Salt Lake City, which I was.
Well, even if you were not accepted, on the other hand, you said that your naivety and your innocence in a way allowed the people's trust in you to build, because you must have impressed so many of these local people to tell you their most intimate stories, Carol.
Well, they were in a state of desperation, and so was I. You know, I mean, I was living on next to no money, and I had dropped about 40 pounds, and it was a struggle. I didn't have money for gas, so I had to walk to the interviews with all this equipment, and I think they could sense that, you know, that saying, never let them see you sweat. Well, I was sweating, and they were sweating, and then they would tell their story, and they would start crying, and I would start crying, because there's no way not to have an empathy reaction to people who have told you these stories that you never in your worst nightmare could you dream something up like this.
Yeah.
You know, children walking down the aisles of McDonald's with wigs on because they're being treated for leukemia. And not just the first generation, but second and third, and the people didn't even know that they had been exposed and maybe lost 16 people in their immediate family, but then the survivors would have children who would be born with leukemia. And then the third generation would have leukemia. So the genetic makeup was changed by the radiation, because the energy of the radiation would break the DNA and you'd have a cancer-producing gene.
Mm.
And there would be three generations.
And a lot of Down syndromes and mentally retarded children and congenital anomalies occur and still occur.
And now it's getting to the point where immune system diseases in baby boomers are really becoming prominent.
Really?
And it's like adding 10 years of mileage to your car. You know, when you're exposed to radiation like that, you can't expect to survive. You're giving up 10 years of your life at least if you survive that long.
Yeah, and enhances or hastens aging as well as the diseases associated with aging. Were you harassed by the Atomic Energy Commission?
No.
You weren't?
No. I mean, I had mail tampering, but I don't know what that was about. There's no way I can prove anything.
Yeah.
And I realized when I was there that paranoia would be my worst enemy, so I kind of ignored it.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the people who were making the nightly death threats for a few months, I got the police to tap my phone to see who it was. And it was a downwinders group who were very upset that I had gotten a grant from the MacArthur Foundation, and they started acting out. And then they started spreading slander that I kept them from getting any money from foundations. And, you know, it's gone on now for 20 years.
Mm.
It's just insanity.
Are they still at it?
Oh, yeah. That's all they can do is this radiation work. And they're almost felons. And right now I'm fighting two plagiarism cases where they just took my book and made things out of it without permission, and another when I objected to one woman writing a play based on my book without any attribution, she had a stalking injunction put out against me, and I live in another state, saying that she feared for her life. So it's called the long arm of Utah law. They had this sheriff come here to my house in Colorado to serve me with civil stalking injunction papers. I mean, these people do not give up. Because I'm an outsider.
I come back to Germany again, you know. I do. I mean, the people.
Poor Germany.
Well, no, the people who did these, well, horrendous isn't really the word to describe it. Killed their fellow countrymen. Knew damn well what they were doing. They knew about radiation. In fact, you know, I've just read an article by Oppenheimer. He knew. They all knew.
Yes, he did.
They all knew. And, you know, I worked with a lot of the fellows who were in the Manhattan Project talking about the medical effects of nuclear weapons. They never talked about the downwinders. They knew about it. And they were so guilt-ridden, of course, about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the arms race that they developed nuclear power to solve their consciences. But they knew about these downwinders. And it's extraordinary.
And the test site workers, even worse, you know, I mean, just being on the test site day after day, and the atomic veterans, I've never had my heart broken so much as by the atomic veterans.
Tell us what they told you, Carol.
Well, you know,
these were soldiers.
These were soldiers, and they were either put in foxholes or told to stand on the side of a hill, or just on plain level ground without protection at all. Some from maybe 3 miles from ground zero, some 6 miles. And one man, Robert Carter, told me that they were the ones that were against the mountainside, and he refused to put his hands over his eyes like they were told to, because the soldiers would say they could see their skeletons, the light was that bright, but he refused to do it. And all of a sudden, his whole platoon is up in the air 30, 40 feet from the shockwave and the blast and everything like that, and they're all like tin soldiers being thrown in the air. And once they recover from that, they're vomiting, and they're put on a bus, and they're driven to ground zero to do military maneuvers right on that same spot where the bomb went off. And what Robert Carter told me, and I had to get some corroboration from other soldiers, which I did, so because it sounded too crazy for me, he said he saw people near ground zero in cages, like hurricane fence kind of enclosures, handcuffed to the fences with just what was left of their trousers on. So they were doing human experiments, and I started looking into that, and it turns out I interviewed the man who lives in Albuquerque, who was in charge of the airplanes to bring these men from Panama in cages.
Panama.
And bring them to the test site.
What?
Exactly. I ran out of his house. I just didn't want to hear anymore. He was in charge of that. He was also in some of the chemical weapons experiments, and he just ripped open his shirt and showed me his chest, which was all scarred from chemical weapons tests in Maryland. So I've seen it all, you know, I mean, in some ways. And the thing for a journalist is, you know, to verify.
Yeah.
So I had to verify Robert Carter, and I got it verified not only by other soldiers who had been there, but by the man who actually brought the people to be experimented upon. So, I, you know, it's for me, if I never do another book again, it will be fine.
Well, you know, they did this to see how humans could survive in a radioactive environment after a nuclear war and how soldiers could operate. I mean, you know, it was a military maneuver as well as a scientific and medical maneuver.
And it was also a psychological, it was psychological more than anything, because they knew that these men were guinea pigs.
Mm.
I mean, they all the victims now say that they were guinea pigs. But they knew that these men would come down with terrible diseases, multiple myeloma, leukemia, cancer of almost anything.
Mm.
And so what they were really checking on at that point was what the human being could endure psychologically.
Well, did they follow these men during their lives and do psychological studies on them till they got their cancers?
Very briefly, and in fact, Robert Carter, the man I mentioned who saw the people in the cages, was taken in by the AEC and questioned. And when he said that he had seen that, they started medicating him. And they said, if you ever tell anybody that you saw this, you'll be court-martialed, we'll go after your family, that kind of thing. I mean, that was pretty common. I wouldn't say that they were given any palliative care for post-traumatic stress disorder or anything like that, because, you know, at the time, soldiers came back from World War II with shell shock and disoriented, and Vietnam, and, you know, the soldiers were not taken care of at that time.
Well, I do know in my many years of working with this subject that if there are whistleblowers in the nuclear power industry, quite often they are removed from their jobs and given psychiatric treatment.
Right. Well, whistleblowing
Russia.
Is not a good state of mind.
It sounds like Russia. You know, that's what they do with people.
Well, it's anybody who tells the truth.
Well,
it's very discouraging.
Now, okay, so the next question, Carol Gallagher, is how is your book, American Ground Zero, published by MIT Press in 1993, received by the people in Utah and Salt Lake City?
Well, a few, you know, there were pockets of intellectuals and, you know, academics at the University of Utah, and some in the art circles and literary circles in Salt Lake. They got really frightened by it. You know, just one reviewer said, it's the most frightening thing I've ever heard of in my life. Mm. People were getting seriously messed up in their heads about a project, you know, that had been published by a very serious publisher, MIT, and that had exposed this for what it was. Mm. Now, that was Utah, but then the Mormon Church took it off the bookshelves at Brigham Young University, saying it wasn't true. And at the university, they had a demonstration of students who had lost parents and siblings and all of that, saying, it is true, it is true, you know. Mm. So that was my first notion, that there was a connection there that I didn't trust. But that was Utah, and then the rest of the world really embraced it, and especially outside of the United States. I got interviewers from Norway and France and everywhere coming to my house. And that, you know, it seemed more believable to people who were not Americans. Because why would Americans want to believe we could do this? You know, does anybody want to believe we can do this? I mean, it's just the most horrifying thing you could ever think of, that you do nuclear experiments on your own people. You'd have a nuclear war within the confines of your own country. It's a lot of bombs, you know. And plus, the underground tests after 1963 leaked a lot of radiation as well.
I know. How many above-ground tests did they do, both in the Pacific and in America, Carol Gallagher?
I don't know that number, because it's been since 1993 that I've been trying to let this go.
Oh, I see.
But there were close to 1,000 nuclear weapons detonated at the test site, and only 126 were above ground, but that's plenty, I think. And then the rest were underground and different other experiments.
Oh, and many in the Pacific as well.
Yes, many in the Pacific. The really big ones were in the Pacific, and they said, well, we can move these people from their islands. And they're only savages. They won't mind moving to another palm tree island. You know?
Didn't someone compare them to mice or something and said, you know, well, they're not mice?
Well, that was in my book. That was one of the quotes. It's true they're savages, but they're more like us than mice.
That's right. Who said that? Oh, it was the Atomic Energy Commission.
Yes, it was
one of the papers.
AEC fellows.
Oh.
Now, it's amazing what can be done in the name of national security.
Oh, well, national security, you mean patriotism, and it goes way back in history, way, 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 way back.
Maybe it's original sin. You know, maybe the human being is endowed with certain rights and certain sins, and that being able to do this is just part of the genome that we don't like to understand is there.
Yeah. I'm reading an interesting book now called The Sociopath Next Door. and it said that the midbrain, the limbic system, gets turned on by two things, by sex and by aggression. And that releases dopamine, like taking a drug, and it's a high. It's like having an orgasm. Of course, it fades after a while, but those two emotions turn on the limbic system. I'm going to explore this because I'm going to write a book about the whole thing. What I want to know, though, Carol, is did you make any money from your book? How many have been sold?
I'm still in debt. I owe about $20,000, and luckily the person I owe it to is extremely wealthy, and I may have it forgiven. Mm. He's forgiven the interest on it, but that's since 1983 that I've owed the $20,000. Mm. And then the book sold well, and then Random House came out with a paperback edition, and that didn't sell as well because at the same time there was a biography of Marlon Brando they were promoting, so all the money went to this biography. And you need money to make money, and you need the publicity and all of this.
Well, did you make, how many sold at MIT?
10,000.
And so you must have made some money from that.
I made, after paying off most of my debts, I think I made about $60,000 for 12 years of work.
And now it's still in print.
It is.
I, once again, everyone listening to this program, whether in Canada, the United States, or in Australia, you must get a copy of this book and you must read every single page and look at all the photographs to get an innate understanding and an emotional understanding, I think, of how the nuclear age began.
And also how sweet these people were that, that met with, I mean, the faces of these people and the kindness and the goodness. That's the part that reminds me of being of people being taken on the train to the death camps. You know, I mean, the sweet faces of people that couldn't believe what was happening.
Totally trusting.
Mm. Yeah, totally trusting and encouraged to trust. I think the encouragement is what irks me the most. You know, who's encouraging these people to die? You know, who's telling them the big lie? And saying this is a moment in history you're participating in, and you should be grateful.
Well, I read an article. You know, as you said, Oppenheimer comes out looking, smelling like roses, and Edward Teller was the really wicked thing, person who destroyed Oppenheimer, of course. But and Oppenheimer died of lung cancer, but he was a voracious smoker. But in fact, Oppenheimer was part of this cover up, and he liked to see the weapons or like to have them tested. He was an integral part of this, as were, I mean, who knows how many other scientists and what their names were, because they're probably mostly dead now, who participated in this moral, medical outrage.
Yeah, and it's not just the physicists, it's also the medical doctors,
mm-hmm.
it's the people who examined people with skin peeling off and their hair falling out and saying that they had housewife syndrome or that they were neurotic.
They had acute radiation sickness. And also, we knew that from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki data. We'd never seen it before in medicine, acute radiation illness. They were well aware of that. I had one more question and I can't think of it.
No.
We're just about out of time, Carol. Have you anything else to conclude in this discussion that you would like to say?
Well, I'd like to say that, you know, I have a fresh admiration for the people of Utah and other Mormon areas of the country who had the guts to come forward and speak up when they were so discouraged not to. And, you know, that it was to a point almost of excommunication if they spoke up against the bomb, and yet they did, and because they had a moral sense. And I think that, you know, a religion can give you a moral sense, and it also can do evil things. And I think the evil part is any kind of collaboration that would go on to allow people to be murdered.
Yeah, evil. That's evil. Thou shalt not kill.
Well, any religion can do that.
Yep.
You know, if 9/11 could happen because they thought people in New York City were evil and not Muslim, that's one thing. But everybody has a belief system that can either do a good thing or an evil thing. And it's just the human being at a crossroads of choices.
At the present moment in history. The other thing I wanted to point out, and I've remembered what it is that forever and now still, the real medical effects of radiation are still being covered up by people who call themselves health physicists.
Yeah.
They're not doctors, they're not biologists, and they are protégés of a man called Morgan. What is his name? K.Z. Morgan.
Carl Morgan.
Carl Morgan, who was the father of health physics. And he said that these people who became health physicists have prostituted themselves to the nuclear industry, whether it's the weapons industry or the nuclear power industry. They're apologists, and they get up at every meeting and will deny what the doctors say and what is the truth. We are in a mess, and I think, Carol Gallagher, you've helped to unearth the truth, and you've been, for the last 5 years, writing books and recovering from your surgeries after your accident. But I would encourage you to keep on. I've rarely met such an intelligent, brave, courageous person. You're really a pioneer.
Well, thank you.
And you've done more work than Carol Silkwood than Silkwood did. And she was, of course, murdered, as we know.
Well, I'm not getting murdered anytime soon, but
no,
I must tell you that I took a wonderful photograph of Carl Morgan and Alice Stewart together at Hanford. There was a radiation conference there, and I went up to Hanford where they manufactured the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb.
Yeah.
And so I took this wonderful picture of the two of them together, and now they're both deceased, as we know, but... You know, it's. I've taken pictures of a lot of heroes. I would consider the downwinders and the atomic vets and other people who speak up to be heroes, and also Carl Morgan and Alice Stewart. And you, my dear. We really appreciate your work.
Well, I do yours too, Carol.
Thank you.
I thank you very much for this interview. I hope it really impresses and impregnates people's emotional core so that they're impelled to A, read the book, and B, to rise up and do something about it. And I'm sure most people listening to this program will act accordingly. So thank you, Carol Gallagher.
Thank you so much, Helen. It's a great honor to speak with you.
Thank you. My guest today was Carol Gallagher, a photographer and author of American Ground Zero, The Secret Nuclear War, which was published in 1993 by the MIT Press. Thank you for listening today, and we'll have another fascinating subject for you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.